Your eyes on the times, you walk ready to speak up. But with so many problems, you're exhausted trying to keep up.
This is the Church Politics Podcast, where you can get political commentary from a biblical worldview. We're not trying to be conservative or progressive. We're trying to be Christian in the public square.
And I'm black as heaven. I'm made in God's image. Nobody can change my settings. Amen. Cut off my knees and put an end to my search. It's easy to sell your soul when you don't know what it's worth.
How's it going out there? All right, we are in Denver. I'm so glad to be here. And if you didn't know, that's actually our theme music for 2024. Everything is going to be all right, and that's a matter of faith. But let's get this started in the right way. As you know, this is the Church Politics Podcast. So as we always started off, would you know good, Ann Kemp? You're listening to the Ann Campaign's Church Politics Podcast with Justin Gibney, a.k.a. Bishop Cooper's grandson, and the Windy City representative, the baddest brother above the Mason-Dixon line, my play cousin, the Right Reverend Christopher Butler. Now, we are in Denver, which is my hometown, and I don't have a whole lot of time for the intro today, but I do want to recognize that this is the city that put the Lakers out of their misery this year. So I want to thank everybody here for at least that. Because even if you didn't get the championship, you did something very good for mankind, and we all appreciate you for that. Any thoughts on that, Chris?
I forgot about that, but shout out to Denver for taking care of the Lakers. I just told somebody the other day that I don't watch enough basketball anymore, but I watch enough to root against the Lakers.
You got to check it out. You got to check it out. Now, as always, I want to give a shout out to all our supporters for supporting us in what we do and how we do it. If you are watching this live on YouTube, make sure that you like and subscribe so we can kind of work with this algorithm that's been troubling us for some time, but hopefully we can get through it. And also, just want to say, any support we can get, we greatly appreciate it. There's a reason that not a lot of people talk about the issues the way that we talk about them. It's because it's hard to get support. So any support that we get, we appreciate it. You can go to patreon.com/churchpolitics and you can become a subscriber, and you will actually get premium episodes. So we have those two, and I'm just really excited about this conversation and really just in general about our civic revival tour. I want to give a huge thanks to the Ed Campaign, to the Denver chapter, for all you guys are doing. This is an excellent event, and for everybody that came here, give yourselves a round of applause. Excellent job. Now, also, as we go through this, remember, there will be a Q&A at the end, so get your questions ready as we go so you can get engaged with us, all right? So grab your Bible, get your mind right, and prepare to think. Not like a Republican, not like a Democrat, but to think like a Christian. And let's start off with scripture. I want to go, Chris, if you don't mind, to Exodus chapter 18, verse 21. And it says this: "But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens." Many of you may know this is Moses's father-in-law, Jethro, basically telling him what type of leaders he'll need to recruit to help him out in general, but to help him provide justice and order for the people. And some of the things we heard were capable men. The word used here means able, strong, efficient. We also heard trustworthy, truthful, dependable, stable. Now, as I've been traveling, even when I was coming here, everywhere I went, Chris, it seemed like people were talking about the debate that just happened a couple of days ago. Everybody is talking about the presidential debate, for better or worse, usually worse. And really one of the things that I'm hearing over and over is the fear that one of the candidates is not capable, right? And the other candidate does not seem to be truthworthy, among other things, in both respects. All right. But it's not just me saying this, Chris. I want you to hear what the New York Times editorial board actually had to say after. And this was yesterday, late yesterday, what they actually had to say after the debate. They said President Biden has repeatedly and rightfully described the stakes in this November's presidential election as nothing less than the future of American democracy. Donald Trump has proved himself to be a significant jeopardy to that democracy, an erratic and self-interested figure unworthy of public trust. The clearest path for Democrats to defeat a candidate defined by his lies is to deal truthfully with the American public. Acknowledge that Mr. Biden cannot continue his race. To serve his country, President Biden should leave the race. Now, this is the New York Times editorial board. I don't think they've ever said anything like this, but one thing that we both, I'm gonna pass to you in a second, but one thing that we both have said in our conversations after the debate was, this was the worst debate that we've ever seen in our lives, especially when it comes to presidential stuff. I mean, I used to debate in high school, and I think if my teacher would have saw me debating that way on either side, yep, she would have been very disappointed, and I obviously wasn't running for president. So on one side, you had Biden, who was incoherent. I mean, it seems like after a couple sentences, he was just getting lost in what he was saying. Then you had Trump, who I will give him was a lot more composed than he usually is. That actually surprised me, but wasn't any more substantive or wasn't any more truthful than usual. What is your take, Chris, on this debate and what it means for the election?
Well, as you alluded to, I think it was definitely the worst, probably the worst debate, certainly the worst presidential debate I've ever seen. You know, if you work with like third graders, I've worked with like third graders doing debate, so it might be on that level. But it's alarming to see that these are the candidates that are put forward by the majority, the two established political parties for president of the United States. So when I watched the debate, that was my big takeaway, is what is wrong with our system that this is what it produced? And I think for me, you know, that's where I come away. Even when I read the New York Times, their editorial, I felt like it's too little too late, because it's hard for me to believe that the New York Times editorial board was not aware of President Biden's mental and physical state up to this point. This has been something that has been well documented, there to see if you wanted to see it. And I think a lot of people in the country have seen it. For about 8 months, people have said in poll after poll that they feel like Joe Biden is too old to run for president again, that somebody else should be on the Democratic ticket. And yet members of the media, members of the Democratic Party, members of the White House staff, the campaign team, all were complicit and covering this up from being mainstream. And so when you get something like we had the other night, where I think I saw 4 out of 5 registered voters in the United States watched that debate, and everybody sees it, I think a lot of people in the sort of pundit class who were, you know, they were playing shocked. But they weren't that shocked, because they've seen this on display for a long time.
They were hoping for better. So it's one of these situations where either the press knew or they should have known. Yeah. And they should have reported on it differently and actually not taken some stories that showed this obviously happening and explaining it otherwise, or throwing, you know, all kind of misdirection in there. I think that is very disappointing. One thing that you were telling me, and I don't want to steal your thunder of this, so I'm going to pass it back to you. You were saying there was something, one answer that Trump gave that was very disturbing to you, and I wanted you to kind of talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, and so I intentionally watched the debate with some friends who are not super political, because I wanted to see how somebody who's not like me, drinking politics all the time, was reacting. And there was one part of the debate that got a visceral reaction, the way that most everything Joe Biden did got a visceral reaction. And that's when the moderators asked Donald Trump 3 times in a row, will you accept the outcome of the election? And 3 times he refused to answer that question. And I think that it was a really missed opportunity for Donald Trump. I feel like I've been looking at some of the polling, and we can get into this a little bit, but the polling that's coming out today is suggesting that voters didn't move as much as we might think when it comes to how they plan to vote. And I think one of those reasons is Donald Trump missed the opportunity to look at the camera and say, yes, I will accept the outcome of the election. I think if he had done that, there was a lot to gain with moderate voters.
You think voters that weren't voting for Trump would have voted for him if he said that?
I think independent voters, you're not going to convince hardcore Democrats, but you know, these elections come down to swing voters. And I think a lot of swing voters who are looking at both candidates and at that moment are really shaken by what they're seeing from Donald Trump. And if they were able to, I mean, from Joe Biden, if they're able to see Donald Trump look at the camera and say, look, if I lose the election, you know, I lost the election, I'll, you know, take my legal recourse. But after I've gone through all my legal recourse, if I lost the election, I lost the election, I move on with my life. I think he could have made up a lot of ground with swing voters. And I think he left it on the table. I think he certainly had something to lose with his base, but he had a lot more to gain, in my view, with swing voters than he had to lose with his base.
Fair enough. Maybe in the future you'll convince me of that, but there'll be other episodes to do that. And so we'll continue to move on. But to your point, and in a serious note, there wasn't a lot of substance there, and he did, I mean, he had a chance to kind of clear some things up, and he didn't. And that's a primary concern from a lot of people with Trump. One thing I thought, because just so you know, we critique both sides, right? So this is not saying who you should vote for or one. We're just putting it out there and you make your decision. One thing I thought he actually looked prepared for, because everything else he said Biden's the worst president ever like 50 times. One thing I thought he was actually prepared for, and that he did well politically speaking, not necessarily ethically speaking, was his answer on abortion. I thought he was very prepared. If you look at what a lot of pundits are saying, that's the weakness, especially when it comes to the suburban mom, right? The suburban mom, the Roe versus Wade decision was Democrats' probably biggest way to get them back into the fold. And I think he handled that question really well, right? So he talks about all that this did was send it back to the states. Everybody wanted it sent back to the states. In fact, he didn't say this, but Joe Biden was against Roe versus Wade when it first came out. And so he's taking a whole different position. Trump didn't say that, but he actually is. And then he just talked about, well, some states had become more liberal and whatever. And I think he was clearly prepared for that question, even if he wasn't prepared for any of the other ones. But, that did stick out to me.
I think he nailed that question. And again, if I'm Joe Biden, you want to parry that and say, but if Congress passes a ban, are you going to sign it? And instead he went to talking about immigration.
Yeah.
And it's right. Just, it was tough.
Was pretty obvious. Now, we're going to go through these somewhat quickly. We have some great guests that are coming up to join us in a little bit, so we want to make sure that we give them their time. And so I'm going to go all the way to the next subject, which is, and I imagine some of you heard of this, Louisiana's Governor Jeff Landry recently signed legislation requiring the Ten Commandments to be displayed in all public classrooms. All right? Interesting. Now, a lot of people online have been saying, hey, Ann Campaign, what do you think about this? And it's an interesting one because I do love God's law. I think everyone should be familiar with it. I want everybody to be familiar with it. I want people to seek to abide by it. But I'll be honest with you, Chris, this doesn't really excite me because of the spirit behind it. Right. We should definitely be finding opportunities to evangelize wherever we should. I believe in that. Truly do. We should be trying to expose people to God's word and what and his design and what he says is right. But doing it through public institutions, when you wouldn't appreciate somebody else doing it through public institutions, or when you can't complain about other ideologies, whether it be pride or whatever, when them doing it in public institutions, you can't really have it both ways, right? If you're going to use public institutions, then expect other people to use public institutions for things that you don't like. So for me, Chris, this was a very thinly veiled culture war fodder, right? This is about politics. This is not really about God's law. It's using the Ten Commandments, in my opinion, as a political football to get some Christian conservatives riled up. And it doesn't seem to me to be a product of some type of theological reflection or loving, you know, putting the love of your neighbor in action is just another one of those issues you threw out there. And I don't appreciate the Ten Commandments being used that way. I think there's actually other ways in public to convince people that Christianity is a way. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, you know, you're taking the Ten Commandments, the first one is to honor the Lord. And I think when you take the Ten Commandments, and like you said, turn it into a political football, because there's something dishonoring to God about that, because it doesn't seem to me that the spirit of the legislation was to really hold God, to hold the law of God in very high esteem. And that is very, very disappointing. So I've suggested in a couple of places that maybe we should contend for the Beatitudes to be posted in some places that would call us to a place of really figuring out how we love our neighbor, how we bring the compassion of Jesus alongside the sort of the law of God into the public discourse.
Yeah, and I've actually got a chance before this to speak to some legal scholars about this particular issue. Even the ones that disagreed with it said that it is, they think it's constitutional. So they think it will be upheld. So that means they can do it, should they do it. Especially when we talk a lot about civic pluralism, we live in a diverse society. How do we respect other people while at the same time trying to show them, mostly I think through our actions, not just putting up a poster in the school that most kids are going to walk by and not even really pay attention to. How do we do that in a better way? I just don't think it's effective evangelism. And I think it's one of those one-up, culture war one-ups, like, oh, we got you. This is going to really make them mad. And it's going to be a lot of wasted resources for not only governments, but I think that could go in other places that I think would be more valuable. So, all right, next, and be writing down your questions. If you disagree with us on this, please, we're open books. We want to hear what you have to say in our Q&A. So that's coming up, guys. Don't forget to be writing down your questions. The next thing that's been interesting to me, Trump. I was disgusted with his comment earlier, but I didn't mean to take it that far. The next thing that I want to talk about really quickly is, you know, we've talked about a couple of times how Federal Trade Commission Chair Lina Khan has really been doing, I think, a smart job. So she has been cracking down on monopolies. Yeah. And I think in a smart way, not in a, oh, I just hate capitalism way. Not like this is a clear violation of the law. Let's make sure these monopolies are getting broken up. Because even, and we've been making this argument for a minute, if you care about capitalism, if you think it can work, you should want her to do the work that she's doing. Because a lot of people are realizing that the way that things are going right now, that our economy is not working for them. So if you want to push back, if you're someone who wants to push back against social and all these other things, you should want smart regulation. One of the things that always upsets me is when people are like, I'm either pro-regulation or against regulation. And it's like, well, what regulation are you talking about? Are you against child labor laws? No, it depends on what the regulation is, right? Or do you want barbers and companies to be, you know, to be regulated out of business? Of course not. So we shouldn't just be for regulation or against it. We should want smart regulation.
Iowa. My neighbor state in Iowa, they are against child labor laws. So...
I'm guessing I could name a regulation that each of you would be like, that makes sense. So the point we're saying is like, we need to think through those things. But I think the work that Lina Khan is doing is honest, doesn't seem overly ideological, but it is making some people who have these monopolies a little bit upset.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I saw earlier was Trump seems to be cozying up to a lot of the groups that may be not benefiting from this crackdown. And so it's interesting. I was reading The Guardian and it said this: Trump met at the business roundtable headquarters with 80 CEOs, including Apple's Tim Cook, JP Morgan's Jamie Dimon, and Walmart's Doug McMillon. And he promised them, all these CEOs, that he was going to cut corporate taxes and even curtail business regulations if he was elected president.
Yep.
And I've had a lot of criticism for Biden, for Biden's administration. That is the one of biggest bright spots to me. And so it is worrisome to hear that he might kind of, that he might come in and take away all the progress that's been made in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, this sort of dragged me onto ground that I don't want to be on, because I put it in that lesser of two evils category. But it is a huge problem. You know that one of the biggest problems I think we have in the United States is the this growth of corporate power. And like you said, one of the bright spots of this past administration, or this, it's not a past administration currently, it's the current administration, but it has been their work in antitrust. We have monopolies in everything from meatpacking to media. You have permanent capital buying up, single family homes all over the country. You have labor abuses and trucking and warehousing and hospitality. And so the work that the Biden administration has done in antitrust, and honestly the work that the Biden administration has done in labor, hasn't been as much as I thought it would be. But his NLRB, that's the National Labor Relations Board, like you mentioned, Lena Khan, this has been good work. And the last time, I guess you would have to go back to 2016, but when Donald Trump first came onto the scene, a big part of his sort of drain the swamp vibe was very sort of anti-corporate.
It was populist, so that's why a lot of these groups weren't necessarily in support of him the first time, because he ran as a populist, but obviously, didn't really do all that much outside of maybe international stuff.
His administration was certainly not as aggressively anti-corporate as his campaign was. And so if his campaign is not even anti-corporate, the next administration might be something scary.
And that's the thing. I don't even think we need anti-corporate. I think we need smart regulations of corporations, so we don't see as much corporate capture in these different spaces, and that's one thing that worried me. Now we talk also about, when it comes to Biden enters, talking about running as one thing but being something else. I think the reason that Biden won was because he came in as a very sensible, middle of the road person when it came to a lot of issues. But when you look at transgender issues, a lot of those issues, that's not where he stayed.
No.
He kind of flowed. I think there's a valuable criticism to say he flowed to the left and kind of let the left take over on those particular issues. And so we see in these instances, two people ran as something and did something different. How do we start to hold people accountable for that and let them know, no, we saw what you did and we're not going to let you get away with it. So we see that stuff happening, and it's on us to be able to call that out.
Are you too progressive for conservatives and too conservative for progressives? As a Christian, do you find yourself feeling politically homeless? If so, then you're not alone. Listen, this is Justin Gibney, president of the AND campaign. And if you're a Christian who doesn't know a whole lot about politics, or someone who knows a good deal about politics but wants to be more faithful in the public square, then you have to read the AND campaign's book, Compassion and Conviction, the AND campaign's guide to faithful civic engagement that we publish with InterVarsity Press. Whether you just want to understand the relationship between church and state, why Christians should engage politics at all, how Christians should engage partisanship, politics and race, advocacy and protest, or even civility, this is the book for you. It's very much Bible-centered. It's Bible study and small group friendly. There are questions and exercises after every chapter that give you a framework for engaging politics in a biblical way. So if you want to do it in a better way, get our book, Compassion and Conviction, the AND campaign's guide to faithful civic engagement.
It's time for us to have our Q&A. So let's get to it. We got 10 minutes for a Q&A, and I think we have, is there a mic going around for the Q&A?
There'll be two mics. I have a question. Yeah. You commented on the Louisiana Ten Commandments thing, and then following that was what happened in Oklahoma just a day or so later. And I'm interested in what your comments are on the overall school district in Oklahoma teaching religion or teaching Christianity in the classroom.
Well, I don't know all the details of the Oklahoma thing. I don't think it's a problem to teach a religious course where kids learn about a religion. I think that's fine. I think we have to understand that we shouldn't do anything to other people's kids that we wouldn't want them to do to us. So if my kid learns about Islam, I don't have a problem with that. If he's in school and it's being promoted in a certain way, as if the assumption should be that's right, I have to consider, I'm not going to do that to them because I wouldn't want them to do that to me. And there's tons of opportunities for us to evangelize, for us to proselytize in other spaces. But when people take their kids to a public school, that's not what they're agreeing to. And I think we have to be very respectful of that. And anybody who thinks that means, well, you don't care about, no, I just know there's other ways to do it and probably far more impactful and effective ways to do it than that. And it shows a good faith to say, even when we could do it, I'm not going to do that because I respect you and my word really means something. Thank you for that question, though.
I think it's very obvious that that Jesus wouldn't be right or left. And I think this is the first time in my life I'm going to vote independent, probably. But do you think it'd be possible to create a party with ideologies based on biblical principles that the U.S. church could actually get behind? Do you think it's possible to bring the church together into kind of pulling from both sides, that middle, or whatever Jesus, like if Jesus were running, could he make a platform that you think a lot of us could get behind? What would that look like?
Yeah, I think the Solidarity Party is the closest that you're going to get to it.
Yeah, I think the Solidarity Party, well, I know the Solidarity Party grows out of the international Christian democracy movement, and I think that it is possible. I would caution such a movement against saying this is what it would be if Jesus ran. But to have a political party that whose ideology grows out of Christian thought, I think is not only possible, but increasingly necessary. Like, and if not a political party, I'm sure, so I'm participating in the AIM campaign, that the church needs a church-based political project.
Yeah, and I would say the tough part about third parties, and I really do like, take a look at this, their agenda and their platform, because I think the Solidarity Party has taken some time and it's really thoughtful, and I think a lot of Christians will agree with it. But honestly, and I've said this to them too, it's very tough for a third party. So I think because the system just isn't set up for it, right? You got to do all this extra stuff and you're going to spend a lot of money that you would need to actually run. So it's tough. But in the meantime, we don't necessarily have to have a third party. We just need Christians who are independent enough to be in a party, but say, I'll vote for whoever the best person is. Which goes to Chris's point. We need a project to get Christians to be more open to doing that. And they can stay in their respective parties, but just come together when need be.
And either way you do it, and I'll stop here, but I really urge people, and I've also said this to the ASP, to focus local, right? Like if I were in charge of the ASP, and I'm sure somebody from the ASP will hear this, so I'm going to say it clearly. Like if I were in charge, I'd be focused on like school board elections right now. Because if you get 5 school board members elected in a county, then somebody can run for a county position and be endorsed by 5 local elected officials. And that's how you actually build power.
So you third parties hear that? Chris has used his bully pulpit to tell you exactly what you need to do. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me? Okay, awesome. Great. Do you have any tools that you can give us so that we can have these type of discourse outside of this space?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the first one is our book. So if you haven't read our book, Compassion and Conviction, you can get it outside, which just gives the framework of how to view politics in a different way, a different lens. Too many Christians are viewing politics from primarily a partisan or ideological lens. If you ask them to talk about their public witness outside of conservatism or progressivism, they wouldn't know how to do it, as if those are the only two ways to go about it. And they're not. and they're made with human hands and they're flawed, but a lot of people don't know how to articulate that. I think our book helps with that. Our 10 disciplines that we were talking to pastors earlier today about is really helpful for that. So yes, we're here as a resource for a church, and we have multiple things that can help people kind of view it differently. And again, viewing it differently doesn't mean all Christians are going to agree. This is a framework. We can disagree, but there are certain bounds that we need to stay within.
And I'll also say the Denver chapter of the AIM campaign is engaging these issues locally.
Hi. First to Justin, I'm a Cherry Creek teacher, Cherry Creek district teacher. My kids are Creek grads. I coached I might have coached against you 97 to 2001 at Eagle Crest. At Eagle Crest.
You recall what happened in that game.
Well, yeah, we weren't at Creek's level, so that's all right. We get
I'm
that.
Missing.
But I've been in the public schools. I'm a public school teacher. I'm a more conservative leaning Christian in a very liberal space in the public schools. And so while our district's done a lot of equity work over the last 20 years, I notice every book we read, whether it's, Bettina Love's about, abolitionist teachers. And one, none of it's coming from a Christian perspective, but it's also very, very left-leaning, you know. And so I find myself, and then, I stumbled onto Ben Watson's book, read that, followed him, then fell into you guys, and which has been wonderful for me. I tend to, when I listen to people like Condoleezza Rice speak, when I've read a couple books of Thomas Sowell's, I feel like those are very research-based, supported, and leaning more on the conservative vein. In your guys' opinion, is like Thomas Sowell's work, his books, his research on kind of some of the social issues, is that, while it may be something you disagree with, which I hear you guys talk about, we can disagree, but think it's still a well-reasoned argument. Have you read him? Do you guys, when you think about that, is that a good source for me looking for? Because I get the liberal side all the time in the schools. And when I listen to you guys, it's a little bit more liberal minded, which is great because it's making me think, it's challenging me, which I really, really appreciate about you too. But I'm like looking for that Christian vein, not the evangelical Christian nationalism you guys also talk about and warn about, but on a more conservative side.
Yeah, so Sowell, I have a lot of disagreements with Sowell. I think some of his stuff, he does research fairly well. I think he was more serious in the past than he has been lately. I think he's fallen into kind of like an industry of saying what certain groups want to hear. And I don't think it's helpful for his community. I think some of the things that he does is without context for how the true impacts of race, that racism had on African Americans. I don't think he always has good historical context for the trauma and what happened. I think there are better resources. That doesn't mean that everything he says needs to be thrown out. I think we need to evaluate what he said, and some of it actually makes sense, and there's some progressives who need to read it and kind of reckon with it. But I think there are better places to go if you want to get a more even-handed view of our history and where we need to go from here. I think he can be overly harsh, and I think he leans in towards a demographic that loves what he hears because it verifies everything they wanted to believe anyway.
Yeah, I think I would say similar. I find Sowell useful for somebody who's coming from a more progressive space, because I think he does do some research, and he's gonna like give it to you in a way that's uncomfortable if you're coming out of a progressive space. But I don't know.
Yeah, but I have read and learned from what he said. I that wouldn't be the first place I stop or something that I recommended for somebody who's trying to find where to move for today or have conversations with African Americans that they haven't had before. That's not gonna probably be helpful for those conversations. But it's something I would say progressives who think progressives know everything should read, and I think you'll learn there's some stuff you're missing. So thank you for that, though. I appreciate it.
I've got a question just about the role of the press in bringing to bear some of the things that you're advocating for and talking about. We have a free press as opposed to a state-sponsored press in our democracy. And so the role of free press is to ensure that citizens will receive a differentiation between fact and opinion, or what is most discernibly truthful, and what is propaganda. And it feels as if particularly if you watch the debate that you commented on, when we're left with a decision between this, which feels like an impossible decision, that it's really downstream from a free press not doing some of their vocational, ethical responsibility to both report and write upon the capability of one candidate, the truthfulness of another candidate. I'm curious if you could just comment on what you would hope for in terms of reform of press and how we might find our way through a pretty biased and fake news, both sides environment.
Yeah, I think it has to start. Number one, let me say this. There are some journalists and there are some commentators who I think do an excellent job that work very hard, not for very much. And just the whole news industry has become tough because it's hard to find a model that works economically, right? And so I do want to acknowledge that and acknowledge that there are folks who do it really well. Too often, though, we've come to a place where a lot of our journalists need to kind of revive there needs to be a revival of ethics and respect for the people's intelligence. Because I think what happens is when you get someone like Trump or wherever, whenever they think there's this massive, even not even just Trump, but even people who have who follow a Christian sexual ethic, for instance, they feel that it's their job to tip the scale, to put their finger on the scale and change how people are thinking. That's the moral thing to do. And that's new. That if you look at the journalistic ethics, that's not necessarily how you, that doesn't mean you can't take a side, but you can't be deceptive in how you report issues because you think one side or the other should win. But that's become kind of the norm to some extent. So yeah, that has to change, but we also need to find models for local news, number one, to get local news back into play, because there's just too much corporate capture of that, in my opinion, too, and it's impacting the news that we get.
Yeah, I would turn to us and say that there is work that we have to do to take our attention back, right? Because those corporate entities are trafficking in our attention, and we give it over to them too freely. And like Justin said, the loss of local press is something that has really contributed to the corporate capture of media. And that's one of the places where I have, as I travel around, I really urge churches, if you're in a moderate sized church, you've probably got most of the resources already that you need to do good local press. And that will be such a service to the community. We do it, the AND Campaign Chicago chapter, we do it in Chicago, and there's nothing like being able to just pick up the phone and call the local alderman who was in that story and say, like, is this for real? Like, did that really happen? Is that really what you think? Give me your take. Type that up in an email and send it out to a bunch of pastors so that they get a better, closer view of what's going on. And most moderate-sized churches have the resources to do that. And so that's one of my, like, campaigns is do local press for your community. Excited to invite up to the stage right now Michelle Warren, who is the co-founder of Open Doors Ministry and an adjunct professor of cultural engagement at Denver Seminary, and Letitia Higdon, director of client services at Alternative, the largest pregnancy resource center network in Denver. So let's give them a round of applause. So great to have you both. We were talking earlier with a group of pastors about our 10 civic disciplines. One of those disciplines, I think like number 9, but it's one that I just enjoy the most, is to get involved in your local community. Sometimes somebody said it really well at the table, that a lot of people watched the debate the other night and they saw the only two politicians in America. And so they became very hopeless, because that is politics and that is all of civics. But the work that you all are doing, I love it, because one is not like hardcore political, because there's so much more to do in public life. And then it hits the local communities. So if you could just take a minute, and we'll start with Michelle and then have Letitia Am I saying your name the right way?
It's actually Leticia.
Leticia. Spanish. It's Spanish. See, I grew up on the west side of Chicago. So I grew up with Leticias. But yeah, talk about your work. Tell us what you do and how it's impacting community.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me here. And I was hearing a little bit about introducing myself with Open Door Ministries and Denver Seminary. But the capacity that I'm here with you all today is actually through my company called Virago Strategies. And I work with pastors and nonprofit leaders who are serving in communities impacted by economic and racial barriers and brokenness, and as a public theologian, help them with their work on public engagement. And it is with that that I'm coming with you today. I've had the opportunity to walk alongside a longtime friend and also nonprofit leader, Jessica Dominguez. And she and her husband, Joey, are co-founders of Abundant Ground Housing, which is a land campaign initiative of Mile High Ministries that looks to develop congregationally owned land for the purpose of 100% affordable housing. So I've been walking with them as their political consultant. And in addition, you can do anything sort of rezoning, et cetera, but really what I'm working with them very specifically is that we're working with some other stakeholders to create statewide legislation that would rezone Colorado, the entire state, that religious and actually higher education communities could use their land, the land that they own, for the purpose of 100% affordable housing, which is an enormous crisis, not just in our state, but around the country.
Absolutely. Okay, let's do Leticia. Tell us about your work. And then we'll chat about these.
So I work at Alternatives Pregnancy Center, and Alternatives has been serving the communities of Denver for over 42 years, long time, with free and confidential holistic services. So we offer unique services that are both counseling and medical to men and women who find themselves in unplanned pregnancy.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So thank you both for the work that you're doing. I've got questions going for in my head for both. So this, tell me the name of the project again.
I don't know if I said YGBE. Did I say the word YGBE?
No.
Because that's kind of the big catch-all. And I'd be curious to know if anybody knows the YGBE or acrostic that's with us today. Sometimes you know NIMBY, mm-hmm. No in My Backyard, which is sort of this cultural and sometimes even, policies that ensure that people will not, be able to live in their communities, etc. But YGBE is Yes in God's Backyard. And it's so that churches can use their land for affordable housing.
So I have a question. How are local municipalities in the state responding to the legislative push?
So we've just begun... So in the state of Colorado and many states around the country, state legislators only meet for a period of time. So we've got an election year, and then we'll have some turnover. But from January to May, we will be in session. And each of the legislators are able to choose 5 bills. And sometimes they can get added on, but that's pretty much the general rule. And so we've actually been working with Senator Julie Gonzalez this last year to see if she could add this idea as a zoning amendment. And you have to make sure I don't get too much in the weeds.
Yes.
Okay, just help me there, all right?
Somebody else, I like the weeds.
Yeah, I was going to say, I just really am very wonkish when we get into public policy. But all to say that we weren't able to add it to an existing bill that was going through the legislature this year. And during that time, we just decided, let's pull together some other faith leaders and stakeholders and begin to write a letter and invite Christian pastors and leaders that have this land that can be developed and benefit from that zoning to start to sign on. So we've got several hundred people who have signed on. And in that process, now that when the state legislature is over, you need to go to like Disney World or something, and many, many actually do. And so I guess we gave them about 2 weeks off and reached out. And so long story short, we are ready for next session. And there's a lot of pre-work that has to happen. But we do have Representative Bosnecker and Senator Gonzalez have both agreed that each one of them will use one of their 5 bills to be the champion of this particular legislation coming in January.
Outstanding. and no sense how the. Okay, we should talk offline because I'm thinking about how this would go in Illinois, and
so,
I can imagine.
Actually, I have a company and I work nationally, and we're talking to leaders in Florida, Tennessee, and some of my hope in this conversation is how many different states can we? And Jessica Dominguez, who really should be at the table and is out of town this weekend, which is the reason you have the interloper of me. But we have said, let's put together a toolkit so that we can get it into the hands of interested people around the country, do some workshops so that we can train faith leaders and pastors to bring this to their state for the purpose of rezoning. You don't just have to do it statewide. We had figured if we couldn't get it statewide, we'd start with our city and county of Denver, etc. So there's lots of ways that you can to get into the fray.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Leticia, so we are just over a year, 2 years post-doc. What has that experience been like for you running pregnancy centers in a post-Roe environment?
Well, that's a huge question and an important question. As we think back post, after the Dobbs decision, one of the things that was critically important in the work that we're doing is the safety of our staff. Yeah. And the clients and patients who are seeking our services. So praise God, we have security measures in place and we have remained safe and we've continued to serve people. And what that means for clients and patients seeking our services, we have seen an increase in people needing our services, free and confidential, holistic services. So yeah, people are coming to us. As you know, we're one of 7 states in the country who have no limits on abortion, and so people are flooding our state and seeking abortion in the state of Colorado. So we have continued to serve, and our services have become more important than ever. So free, confidential, high caliber of care services that we're providing to men and women and the unborn, providing mentoring and wraparound care, case management support, all of those things.
Have you seen a crackdown on pregnancy centers here? Because I know in some states, and I can't remember which one it was, there were basically campaigns to make them Illinois. Pregnancy. Was it Illinois? Okay. Makes sense. Basically campaigns, you know what I mean, campaigns to make them look as bad as possible, as if they're actually some type of malicious organization that's trying to hurt people.
Yeah, we have. There was legislation last year in the state of Colorado trying to limit the work that we're doing related to advertising and abortion pill reversal. So, we have experienced that. And we are not a political organization. We are a service providing agency. So we really try to avoid the political arena because people seeking our services are not in a political, so they're in a crisis. So, but yes, we have.
I hate to hear that. Question for both of you, and I guess we can start here. What is a way that your average everyday Christian can help what you're doing? How can they get involved and help you?
Yeah, so, as I think about just our Christian witness and practice, we have a theology that includes and teaches biblical hospitality. The Greek word for hospitality is actually broken down to philoxenia. Sometimes we know the xenia because of the strangers. Xenophobia is the fear of strangers. And philo is the Greek word for love. And so, or at least one of the types of loves. So we've got actually literally love of strangers. The distinctive of our Christian witness would be that we love our enemies and that we love strangers and that we not only love them, but we do it by demonstrating hospitality. When I think of pieces of legislation like YGBI and then also two that did pass this last year that we were kind of working together, it had to do with ADUs. There's now a statewide law that says anybody can rezone their property to add an accessory dwelling unit, sort of like the granny's suite back behind. That seems like, that everybody should like it, but there's actually a lot of pushback. And another piece of rezoning was that you can have more than 2 people who are not related living in a house. And when you think of affordable housing and you think of a housing crisis and all the consternation around supply and demand, one very practical thing that Christians could do is have a welcoming posture. that it's okay if an ADU is built in the backyard of my neighbor, that it's okay that a church would want to redevelop their land and use it for, not just housing, 100% affordable housing. We as Christians should not, if we're practicing, you know, the Christian faith, we should never be saying no in my backyard. We should always be saying, yes, we welcome you, not just in the, you know, formal policy of God's backyard and sort of the way that we've used that acrostic to explain the religious campaign initiative, but to really understand that we have a supply and demand issue. And if we don't have a posture that is literally the practice of welcoming people we don't know into our communities to allow, you know, our neighbors to build land, build on their land to increase density, then we're going to continue to run up against huge barriers. So I would say a welcoming posture is the biggest thing that would really enable us to have the zoning and the affordability of housing in all communities throughout the state.
Yeah, so we have a lot of supporters and a lot of friends and a lot of care for the work of Alternatives. So people can pray for us, for the work that we're doing, for our staff who are engaged in these courageous conversations every single day. You can participate. You can volunteer with us. We have a variety of ways to serve administratively and directly on the front lines of this work. We have a 24-hour helpline. We are in need of mentors. So if you're a parent, we would love for you to mentor one of our clients and walk alongside them. Many of our clients haven't had a positive parent in their life, and they need that, and they want to be empowered to become a great mom or dad. And then there's financial. We are expanding into Arvada this year, Northwest Denver. And so we are participating in an incredible project called the Bridge Project with Revive Church. Other faith-based community providers are going to be serving that community. It's a partnership between church and city government and the nonprofit community. So all of those ways, prayer, get involved, volunteer, and also think of us financially. Because we are a nonprofit, and every dollar is fundraised and stewarded very well.
Awesome. And I would just add to what you said. I think the folks in here who lean left, and just Christians who lean left in general, need to defend pregnancy centers. The attacks against...
Absolutely.
Yeah, the attacks against... And because you're in the best position to do so, right? And the attacks against pregnancy centers are egregious. There's no justification for them. So if you can't find a reason to say, hey, I need to kind of turn around and talk to the people on my side about it, this should be enough reason for you, because these people are putting in a lot of time and there's no justification for a lot of the pushback that they're getting.
Justin, can I share another way that Please. People, that Christians could really work? So many of us are going to church. We have churches in just some of the major counties in the Front Range area. We have 5,000 acres of undeveloped land. And if we were just to afford, I mean, I don't want to use the word afford, if we would allow this to be considered, and let's say we use 25% of the land of that 5,000, we would be able to have 25,000 units for people and families to live. We have 100,000 housing unit shortage in the state. Okay. And so this is a real practical way to be open to maybe talking to your pastor or your ministry leader, or even supporting places like Abundant Ground Housing, so that maybe your church can't do it, but they can help support organizations that do.
That's good. Thank you.
So I have a question. I have a lot of questions, but on the affordable housing front, right? You're talking to a church member, a church leader, and you know they don't want to live next to a poor person. They hear affordable housing, they hear like drugs and like everything horrible, because of course all poor people are on drugs and horrible. How do you talk to that church member, that church leader who is in that spot?
So I started by telling you, as a political consultant, I was telling you about a bill. I probably should be telling you to call your senator, call your house. I mean, there's a lot of strategies to get legislation, mm-hmm. but I specifically started with biblical hospitality.
Yeah.
Because there shouldn't be a place in our world that others can't join. And when I say housing, that includes, yes, 100% affordable housing in my community, which means their kids are going to go to our schools, and that we're going to be a part of the fabric in the intersection of each other's lives. And this is the way for us to really embrace what Paul was saying in Galatians, his utter frustration with a people group that had been literally pulled apart, and this is the demonstration of their law. And now on this side of Jesus and his peace and the unleashing of the Spirit, now there's no difference between. And so I would be discipling and encouraging, which is a lot of the work I get to do too at Denver Seminary, is this isn't, Michelle, you just have a passion for the poor. I'm like, no, I'm a Christian, and I'm supposed to care about the poor. It shouldn't be exceptional for me. This should be a standard.
And so much of the things that we get wrong in politics aren't based on, like, these complex theological issues. It's based on, did you even listen in Sunday school when you were 10, and they told you to care about the poor, they told you not to spill innocent blood? Like, if we heard those things and recalled them, we would actually be in a lot better space today. I know you got some other... We got a few more. Well, we got about one more question we can ask.
We got like one more question. So just to wax political, I know your organization is not political, but I sit on a board of a pregnancy center in Chicago, and we saw similar legislation, and it was heartbreaking, the silence of the church as that legislation came two votes in the House from passing our legislature, and 100%, if it had passed, our governor would have definitely signed it. How do you talk to the church about showing up on those things?
Yeah, that's important, and it's critical to this work. And the church needs to show up, and it needs to be present. There's a lot of shame in the church around unplanned pregnancy. And so through our communications and community outreach department at Alternatives, we offer churches. We partner with a lot of churches who support the work that we're doing, but we provide a training called Courageous Conversations. And I have some information I can share with people, but it's a really neat training to help pastors and church staff understand how to talk about this topic in their church with their congregation and what it looks like to support the congregation with Christ-like love should one of their members come in with an unplanned pregnancy. So we do it. We really prepare our pastors and our church as well, because we're in this work every single day, and we know how hard and how divisive this topic is. And so we want to be hands and feet for the church in Christ-like way, and give them tools that they need to train up and to be prepared.
Awesome, awesome. Will you all give these two wonderful ladies a round of applause? I'll just say we are so encouraged by their work. We understand the importance of housing and caring for the poor, and we are unabashedly pro-life and believe in the sanctity of life and what pregnancy centers are doing. So thank you so much for being with us. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you so much.